This is the podcast Surgery IC Rounds. My name is Dr. Jeffrey Guy. I'm an associate professor of surgery and director of the Burn Center at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine. The topic that I'd like to talk about today is that of hypercalcemia. We had this came up in a discussion recently, and it is something that you typically will see on board exams, in-service exams, and so even though it's high or potentially malignant levels of hypercalcemia is not something we see commonly, it's something that you need to be aware of what it is and how it manifests and what is the appropriate treatment for it. Just as a general rundown, hypercalcemia is really defined as a ionized calcium of greater than 10.5 milligrams per deciliter. It will often manifest itself with an altered mental status with confusion, lethargy, psychosis, and even coma. Patients will often be hyporeflexic and will have muscle weakness. Other symptoms would include constipation, shortening of the QT interval. That's not something we're often talking about. We're often talking about prolongation of the QT interval, as well as pancreatitis. Now, patients who have chronic hypercalcemia, they could also have things like bone changes and something called band keratopathy, not something that we typically would see in an intensive care unit. And patients may have underlying disease such as hyperparathyroidism, but probably more commonly something like malignancy, particularly in a surgical ICU. Other conditions that can cause malignant or dangerous hypercalcemia is conditions such as sarcoidosis and vitamin A toxicity. As we've already said, hypercalcemia, as far as the definition goes, is defined by an ionized calcium greater than 10.5 milligrams per deciliter. But severe hypercalcemia, with, say, an altered mental status, is a medical emergency. Patients with a calcium level of that level will be admitted to the intensive care unit for close monitoring, intravascular fluid resuscitation, and treatment of the hypercalcemia with some of the medications we're going to talk about. Now, as we've said, hypercalcemia that is that severe and dangerous, resulting in altered mental status and symptoms, is often the result of a malignant process, typical solid tumors, lymphoma, and multiple myeloma. Other conditions of mild hypercalcemia include granulomatous disease, such as sarcoidosis, tuberculosis, and fungal diseases, as well as hyperparathyroidism. Now, whenever we're talking about calcium metabolism, whether it's hypercalcemia or hypocalcemia, we have to remember the metabolism of calcium is really a flux or a balance between the gastrointestinal tract, where calcium is absorbed to the assistance of vitamin D, the bone, where the majority of the calcium stores are in the body, the kidneys, where vitamin D is, for lack of a better descriptor, activated, as well as the extracellular space where the ionized calcium is residing. Hypercalcemia is the result of a failure of the regulatory mechanisms of calcium between all of these various sites, as well as the inability to suppress parathyroid hormone. Now, parathyroid hormone, as you remember, activates or stimulates osteoclasts and mobilizes calcium from the bone. Vitamin D, as we've already mentioned, helps with the absorption of calcium from the gastrointestinal tract. Now, if we look at the hypercalcemia that's associated with just a misbehaving parathyroid, we'll know that that's either from an adenoma or hyperplasia, and that's typically a talk on parathyroid disease as a general surgical talk. And the classic descriptors that were used for people who had hyperparathyroidism are stones, bones, and abdominal groans, because people will manifest with renal stones, bone pain, and other symptoms of hypercalcemia, which include things like constipation and abdominal pain. But in this era where the acumen of the diagnostician physician has almost died because of such a heavy reliance on laboratory and radiographic and ultrasound assessments, most of these cases of hypercalcemia are picked up on just routine chemistries where somebody gets a calcium level, either to evaluate calcium or unintentionally picks it up as part of a broader screening assessment. Now, as we said, that a hyperparathyroidism from either a parathyroid adenoma or parathyroid hyperplasia is picked up if you have the elevated calcium and you also are able to obtain a elevated parathyroid hormone level. Now, we've already established that the most common cause of hypercalcemia that we're going to see in an intensive care unit that's going to require us to treat the hypercalcemia is typically related to a malignancy. And there's a lot of reasons why we can see elements or partial elements of hypercalcemia in a patient who is experiencing a malignancy. But perhaps the most important cause is a release of a peptide by the tumor that has homology with parathyroid hormone. And this has been called the parathyroid hormone-related peptide. The effects of parathyroid hormone-related peptide are similar to those of parathyroid hormone in that it causes increased serum calcium, decreased serum phosphorus. And you could see hypercalcemia from this parathyroid hormone-related peptide in cases of bronchogenic carcinoma and a variety of other malignancies. There are other causes associated with cancer conditions that can result in hypercalcemia other than this parathyroid hormone-related peptide. And this would include things such as bone metastasis, as well as bony destruction. And as you're having the bone mets, you're having a breakdown of the bone resulting in hypercalcemia, as well as the effects of cytokines, including interleukins and TGF-beta. Changing gears, we have abnormally produced vitamin D, which can also be a contributor to the development of hypercalcemia. Excessive administration or ingestion of vitamin D can cause hypercalcemia, but this does not occur immediately. It's not something that occurs rapidly. Toxic doses of vitamin A may also cause hypercalcemia. We've mentioned granulomatous diseases are associated the hypercalcemia, and the way that granulomatous diseases such as sarcoidosis will result in hypercalcemia is an increased production of 1,25-dihydroxycholecalciferol, or that's 1,25-dihydroxyvitamin D. I'm just amazed that I can remember that from my biochemistry days. And what happens in these granulomatous diseases is that cells within the granulomas, typically macrophages, will end up in an increased production of 1,25-hydroxy of vitamin D. And we've already mentioned that sarcoid is probably the best known entity that causes hypercalcemia, but also other conditions such as tuberculosis and fungal diseases will also result in hypercalcemia. What's interesting is that in some of these granulomatous diseases, what's probably more common than the hypercalcemia, i.e. the elevated calcium in the blood, is hypercalciuria, or elevated calcium in the urine. Acute pancreatitis is another cause of hypercalcemia, as well as rhabdomyolysis. Milk alkali syndrome from ingestion of calcium and acids by a patient with renal failure is another cause. And what's interesting about milk alkali syndrome is typically it's one of the rare conditions where you see the combination of both an elevated calcium and an elevated phosphorus. So you have hypercalcemia and hyperphosphatemia. Hyperthyroidism is another rare cause of hypercalcemia, which means since it's rare and we'll probably never see it clinically or detect it clinically, it means it'll probably be on a board exam. And the use of thiazide diuretics actually decrease renal calcium excretion, and it may be a contributing factor. That's an interesting point, is that if you have a patient, we see this done a lot in the intensive care units, that a patient who is hypercalcemia, you know, they've got a low calcium, you're replacing calcium, and they need diuretics, you've got them on Lasix, it may be a situation, since you know you could decrease renal excretion with use of thiazides. Now, we typically think that immobilization will elevate the serum calcium. That's not accurate, but what immobilization does, it exacerbates some of these other conditions we've talked about, so it's not a direct cause and effect. Well, how do these patients present? What are some of their symptoms? Well, they can have lethargy or psychosis. They may develop absent deep tendon reflexes. I don't know when is the last time I checked somebody's deep tendon reflexes. And they can also have muscle weakness. Major complaints can be constipation. And you'd be amazed how an alteration of a person's bowel movements will result in the development of complaints. Patients can actually have polyuria and impaired urinary concentration ability, or basically nephrogenic diabetes insipidus. And the nephrogenic diabetes insipidus can be consequences of hypercalcemia. If you get an EKG in these patients, you may actually see a shortened QT interval. That's not something we talk about much, our shortened QT intervals. And if a patient's receiving digitalis, arrhythmias can result. Hypercalcemia is a known potential cause of pancreatitis, and it is a known potential cause of peptic ulcer disease. We mentioned that you really should suspect anybody who's got malignancies, particularly those of breast, prostate, lung, kidney, liver, and all the head and neck tumors. Patients who have multiple myeloma may also have hypercalcemia. as well as the granulomatous diseases that we already mentioned, like sarcoid, TB, and fungal infections. Well, how do we make the laboratory diagnosis? Well, that's to be pretty straightforward. We get a serum calcium level, and if it's greater than 10.5, you have your diagnosis. Other laboratory tests that you should get is certainly looking at serum phosphorus, as well as your electrolytes and creatinine. If you think the parathyroid may be involved, certainly getting a parathyroid hormone level. Next, we're going to talk about the approach to treatment of a patient who we will see in the intensive care unit with hypercalcemia. Who do we treat with severe hypercalcemia? Are those whose calcium levels 12 or 13, certainly, and any patient who has symptoms, especially if you've got alterations in metal status or seizures. And if you're dealing with alterations in metal status or seizures, you need to be treating those people expeditiously and treating them aggressively. What is your objective of treatment? Well, that's pretty straightforward. You want to lower their serum calcium. And typically this is done by increasing the amount of calcium excreted by the kidneys, as well as the decrease the production or the mobilization of new calcium from the bone stores, as well as trying to slow down absorption from the GI tract. There's really four elements of your approach, or a four-prong attack, when you're taking care of somebody who you're treating with severe hypercalcemia. First of all, you want to expand the extracellular volume. So we do that with volume. And then we give the patient Lasix. Seems counterintuitive, but again, we're trying to treat almost like a toxidrome. So elevate the volume, give the patient Lasix, and then the use of calcitonin and primidronate. And we'll talk about what those drugs are and why we use them. Now, let's talk about how calcium moves around through the kidneys. Now, unbound calcium is filtered through the kidneys, and it's largely reabsorbed. But calcium reabsorption is tied to sodium reabsorption in the proximal portion of the nephron, as well as the loop of Henle. Okay, so the calcium is filtered through the nephron. It's floating through the proximal tubule. It's going to go where sodium is going to go, in the proximal portion of the nephron. Now, if we expand the patient's extracellular volume with normal saline, this decreases the passive proximal reabsorption of calcium. Why? We're putting more salt into the nephron. And loop diuretics are given both to prevent volume overload as well as to inhibit the active sodium reabsorption. And since we're inhibiting active sodium reabsorption, we're also inhibiting passive calcium reabsorption in the loop of Henle. Now, in cases of severe hypercalcemia, and we're talking about patients who are in the intensive care unit, their serum calcium, you know, their ionized calcium is 12, and they're CZ or they have altered metal status, we need to give them aggressive saline because, remember, calcium follows the sodium. So start an IV of 0.9 normal saline and run it at a high rate of about 200 to 300 milliliters per hour. Of course, we're talking about adults here. Now, clearly, you need to judge your volume resuscitation of these patients based on their underlying condition. So if somebody has congestive heart failure or pulmonary edema, congestive heart failure, or they're elderly, they may not tolerate this kind of a volume without developing a pulmonary edema. And certainly, we're going to be giving the patient Lasix as well. Give the Lasix in doses about 20 to 60 milligrams every 2 to 6 hours is whatever you need to maintain that urine output, as well as maintain that natriuresis, or the diuresis of sodium. You don't want to use thiazide diuretics in this case because these drugs have a tendency to cause hypercalcemia, and they inhibit the renal excretion of calcium in the distal tubule. Now, clearly, you know when you give somebody Lasix, well, what are the electrolytes that giving somebody Lasix is going to cause? Well, certainly, well, it causes problems with potassium, it causes problems with magnesium. So as you're treating the patient with hypercalcemia, you're giving them the 0.9 normal saline, you're giving them the Lasix, you're watching their volume status, you have to recognize that by giving them this kind of therapy, we're going to see drops in their potassium, drops in their magnesium. We need to be looking for those, we need to be replacing them as the situation requires. Now, majority of the calcium in the body rests in the bone, and we need to basically kind of decrease the mobilization of calcium from the bone. Now, the bisphosphonates are real effective for the management of hypercalcemia, and they have very low toxicity. In the bisphosphonate, these drugs basically inhibit osteoclasts for a prolonged period of time. What are osteoclasts? Remember, those are the cells that are living in the bone. Now, this is not something that we in the intensive care unit are going to be able to do acutely to rapidly lower that calcium, because these drugs really begin to have an onset in about 2 days. You see their maximal effect of about a week. But most likely the hypercalcemia isn't something that developed over 4 hours. It's something that developed over days. So what we want to do is once we get the calcium down, or we're working to get the calcium down, we also need to be treating the underlying causes, how their calcium got to be 13 or 14. And using the bifosinates, they're very successful, and the majority of the patients will have a return of their calcium to normal, regardless of what was the cause of the hypercalcemia. Now, there are drugs called pimidronate and etidronate. Pimidronate is probably more effective because of its longer duration of action on its effect of hypocalcemia. Pimidronate is typically given as a single dose. It's given IV, typically over 24 hours, and about 60 to 100% of patients having normal serum calcium levels about 10 to 13 days later. If we admit a patient to the intensive care unit tonight with hypercalcemia, the use of pimidronate is not going to make us better tonight, but it is going to hopefully prevent us getting into this situation again. You need to adjust the dose of the pimidronate in patients who have renal insufficiency. Side effects of the pimidronate are relatively minor, and there are newer drugs in the class of bifosphonates that actually even have oral agents that are used mostly for the milder forms of hypercalcemia. And these drugs are also used to prevent osteoporosis. Calcitonin can also be given, and it's got a weight-based dose that's given intramuscularly. It has a slight and short-term effect, but can be used in the initial phase of therapy for the treatment of hypercalcemia. It is non-toxic and acts most quickly of all these drugs that alter bone calcium metabolism. Calcitonin promotes renal excretion of the calcium. It actually helps dump the calcium, much like we're doing with the Lasix, and also inhibits the bone reabsorption and inhibits gut absorption of calcium. So when we start looking at that matrix of calcium metabolism, calcitonin is great because it's really kind of working in multiple areas. It's helping us excrete the calcium like the Lasix and the saline is doing. It decreases the mobilization of calcium stores from the bone, and it also decreases the absorption of calcium from the GI tract. Now, we talked about giving the calcitonin early on through a single weight-based intramuscular dose, and it does work well early on as initial therapy, but its effect does go away after a couple of days, and certainly by the time we start seeing that going away, the effects of drugs like the pimidronate or etidronate will, drugs classified as the bifosphonates, will start to exert their effect. Plecomycin is another drug that blocks the reabsorption of calcium from the bone. You can use it basically in any patient who has hypercalcemia, but it's most commonly used in patients who have hypercalcemia secondary to malignancies. It's given as a slow weight-based dose, given over 3 to 6 hours, and you'll see a decline of calcium of about 24 hours, and it normalizes in about a little bit over half, or about 60% of the patients. You do not want to be using plecomycin in patients who have renal insufficiency, liver insufficiency, or patients who have thrombocytopenia. Plecomycin is not used as much as the bifosphonate drugs, such as the pimidronate. You can hear some of my 5 children crying in the background. I apologize for that. I guarantee you there's no blood or broken bones involved. So when you look at our overall treatment of the patient who has hypercalcemia, you could see that we rely very heavy on the acute phase, particularly if those of us who work in intensive care units, on the use of having the kidneys, being able to get a diuresis going, being able to volume load them with saline, be able to give them furosemide, and basically have the calcium chase the sodium out of the body. But what do we do in a patient who can't tolerate that kind of aggressive volume resuscitation, or a patient who has altered renal function and they're sitting there with a calcium of 12 or 13 or symptomatic hypercalcemia? Well, then we need to really think about using hemodialysis. In patients who have hypercalcemia from elevated vitamin D, in conditions such as granulomatous diseases and patients who, say, have multiple myeloma. Corticosteroids may have a role in those patients. The corticosteroids probably decrease the absorption of calcium from the gut by interfering with vitamin D activation. Therefore, since you're really relying on altering vitamin D metabolism with the use of corticosteroids, you really can't use that as an acute method of treating somebody who's got symptomatic hypercalcemia. You can use gallium nitrate, and that works by inhibiting bone reabsorption but without affecting osteoclastic activity. Some people will talk about the use of sodium phosphate because this has a predictable calcium lowering effect, but what's not very popular about this kind of treatment is, and it's not very commonly used, is because it'll result in precipitation of calcium phosphate in the soft tissues, and that's not a good thing. So there we have a brief overview of the treatment of hypercalcemia, particularly the Lasix and saline loading is something that I've commonly seen on exams, both in-service exams as well as board examinations. You've been listening mostly to the podcast Surgery ICU Rounds, as well as the crying and tirades of some of my five children. I do appreciate the download, and we have further information on the on podcast on the podcast website, which is icurounds.com. My homepage is burndoc.com, where we have articles and other educational materials, particularly for our residents. Thank you for downloading.